Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I'm Daniel Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Keith Smith of SpaTrac, and we have a fun conversation that actually goes in some directions that I was impressed with and surprised by. We start out with the Boston Celtics, high-profile week because of the big games that they played against what ended up being a big game against the Cavs, the game against the Nuggets, and a little bit about the Suns a couple days later. But then we get into what Keith and I do best, I guess you could say, which is the collective bargaining agreement. And Keith and I go down some really interesting roads on the second apron, where this might be going from this point, and thought it was a really good conversation. I joked after we recorded that I may get like three or four column ideas out of this. I don't know if we'll actually do that. Keith should have the right to at least some of them. And this episode is also brought to you by a new sponsor for Real Jam Radio, and that is Mood. You can go to hellomood.com, HelloMood.com, put in the code REALGM for 20% off your order and a free THCA pre-roll. Episode runs a little bit over an hour. There is a lot of really good stuff in here, and I hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You and I talk a lot about the cap, and of course we will do that later on, but you also follow the Boston Celtics very closely, and this has been a week of high-profile games for the Celtics, including a win against the Suns and a couple losses, so one of them was surprising and weird, and we could talk about that a little bit. But just kind of starting more broadly, and we'll get more specifically, you know, you have this week of games, and the Celtics have clearly been the best team in the league in the regular season. Does this run, this stretch, change your feeling about the Celtics' title chances at all?
I would say a little bit. Not meaningfully so. I thought they had a good chance to win the title. I still think that they will win the championship, provided everything is equal. You know, there's no major injuries or anything like that. But that said, there's still some of the same things that are going to be the same things until they're not popped up this week. Get execution in the clutch. What do they do when a team makes a big run at them? Are they just going to continue to just play through? We'll figure it out on the fly. Those are questions that are still open and out there. And then Jason Tatum was not very good in a couple of the games this week and had some struggles. And that turns into, especially the game against the Nuggets, the whole questions of is he going to step up? Now, I personally think that gets a little overblown because we've also seen him be very good in very big spots in the past where he's had, you know, major scoring games and playmaking games and the like. So it changes it a little bit as far as it puts a little more doubt in there. But I'm still there that I think I went into the week thinking Celtics and Nuggets are the two best teams in the league. And nothing I saw in their most recent matchup changed that at all for me. That only cemented to me that those are by far and away the two best teams in the league.
My take is very similar, and it's so funny because I watched that game after the fact because I was unavailable when it aired live. So I knew the result, but I didn't know how they got to the result. And when I was watching the game, for the most part, I was like, oh man, Denver's like, I'm not going to say they're really outplaying them, but like they seemed to be better. And And I still feel that way. I think that Denver, even though certain things went really well for them and certain things went poorly for the Celtics, and of course that is important, there, and I want to talk about some of those nuances, it's also important, if not essential, to note that the Celtics had a chance to take the lead in the last minute of that game, and it was in Denver. And so the idea that, while I thought that Denver had the run of play, and not, you know, exceedingly dramatically so, and there are some advantages that Denver has, it's like, Jason Tatum had a rough game. There were a bunch of other weird kind of anomalous things, including the Aaron Gordon dunk contest that ended up just randomly showing up at moments in that game.
That follow dunk, oh my God, the power he put into that thing. It was like, well, we're headed for yet another rim delay in Denver because he broke it. It was
unbelievable. That was, I kind of had trouble understanding how you can generate that. Like, it's,
yes.
I mean, obviously I'm not nearly tall enough nor athletic enough to even like think about replicating it, but just the idea of like the physics of it, like the ball is so low, it's not like he caught it at the perfect point of jump. It's not like, for example, that the one that went off the backboard where it's like, okay, you're already up there, like your hands are really good, you were able to make the adjustment, where it's like the ball is at your waist and you somehow do like a putback windmill. It's like, that was incredible. But so like there were a lot of things that went well for Denver and a lot of things that went poorly for Boston, and to have it still be that close, I think that bodes reasonably well. I you know, it's definitely like, if you say, oh, they lost to the Cavs, oh, they lost to the, and you know, in shorthanded Cavs, oh, they lost to the Nuggets, that can sound bad, but I think that doesn't convey the full context. And the other thing, and you brought this up, of the Nuggets and the Celtics being the two best teams in the league right now, another kind of significant ripple effect that I was thinking about, not only in that game, but the parts I watched of their Suns game, was just, even if you want to say that Denver has an advantage if these two teams make it to the NBA Finals, and I think that's a fair assertion, though not a definitive one, Boston, in all likelihood, has a significantly easier road to get there. And that makes a huge difference, too.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I couldn't get my mic off mute. Yeah, you're absolutely right with that. I think Boston's path, we'll see. The Bucks feel like they are two steps forward, one step back, maybe about one and a half step forward and a step back. It just feels like every time I'm ready to be like, all right, they've kind of figured it out, they then shoot themselves in the foot in a game. It feels like they should have won, and it's all the same questions are there for them. And then the rest of the top of the East is just so banged up and injured. It's really remarkable. Now, I will say all that with noting, Miami's still just kind of there, and they've hit the point in this arc, especially when it pertains to the Celtics. They're like the classic horror movie villain. Like, if you don't cut the head off, separate it from the body, burn both pieces separately, and bury their ashes in two different oceans, you feel like, no, they're probably coming back and they're going to be a problem. So that's something where I think Miami can be really tough for them. But yeah, you look out in the West, you've got Minnesota and OKC, and we'll see what Minnesota is without Karl Anthony Towns and when he comes back and the like. But you've also got the Clippers, and even Denver, if they get into the one or two seed, maybe they're going to face probably a good chance, you know, Warriors, Lakers, Mavericks, Suns, somebody like that in the first round. That's going to really make them have to work, I think. Even if it's, you know, we go back to, they swept the Lakers, but it was a series of close games. Like, their just path seems to have a lot more potential pitfalls in it than Boston's does. And that's why I feel a little bit more comfortable. Now, I also feel, on the flip side, I feel like the Nuggets are less of a health risk maybe than the Celtics are. I feel like the Celtics, because of Porzingis, it's just kind of always in the back of your head of like, is he going to be there? Is he going to be able to make it through two extra months worth of games to get all the way to where the Celtics want to go? Because that's not something we've seen him do at this point in his career.
It's a great point. And I mean, the challenges, and there have been various players that have talked about this over the years. I think of Draymond Green because I'm around the Warriors a fair amount, and he talks about it a fair amount of like how that is a lot of extra strain, and how it's, you know, as a proportion of the season, having a full postseason run is very different. And the cumulative stamina. And I want to give Joe Mazzulla and the staff a lot of credit for how they've managed Porzingis over the course of this year. And it is relevant that there are no back-to-backs in the postseason. And it actually ties in with something that I remember from a couple of years ago, which is it's going to be extremely important for the Celtics, to me, to, if they can, finish series quickly. Because one of the, and I mean, I think of that as part of the story in 2022, is that, yes, it's part of it is, you know, like you're giving yourself chances to lose if you can't close out a series, you can't do anything else. But the other one is cumulative fatigue and injury risk. And so that, you know, you're not going to be able to win every series in four games. That the fo-fo-fo doesn't really happen anymore. Not that it ever really did in the first place. But getting, you know, if you can get a clean five, if you can get like a maybe a light six where you like the last game or one of the games you're playing your backups a significant portion, that lightens the load significantly enough that it can make a really big difference.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think as I think through the Celtics, it's just if you can win in four, ideally, but win in five, it just takes that pressure off of then, oh my gosh, we've got to close this out. And this is going to be, you know, yet another major, you know, not clutch moment game, but clutch game. Meaning, you know, we've got to get this done. Our backs are against the wall. And that's just where everything gets a little bit tighter. But I really do think they're going to be this team feels different. I don't know any other way to really say it other than that's it. They just feel very different compared to the previous iterations. Now, a lot of that is Porzingis. They just have a lot of different ways they can attack now, especially against mismatches, against zone defenses. He just becomes, whether it's spotting up 5 feet behind the line where bigs, I found really watching Porzingis night to night, every single possession for the first time ever, I never really fully realized how he stresses a defense with a big man, and they're better than this than they've ever been. They're good at closing out to the arc, but they close out to the arc and then they're still like he's two full steps behind it. And he's, you know, 7 foot two, three, four, whatever he is. So it's really hard to even bother a shot anyway. So it's like you see these bigs close out, then they're like, oh, man, I'm still not near him. Like I needed a whole other step. And that opens up a lot. And then the other thing is he's become their zone buster where they just dump it to him around the nail and let him shoot a turnaround or let him go to work from there. And those have been major things that have helped their offense. And then defensively, they're getting a lot of the same production out of him where they've started regularly putting Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum or occasionally Drew Holiday on the other team's five. And they're telling Porzingis, you're going to defend the weakest defender, and then you're just going to roam off him, much like they did with Rob Williams.
Yep.
They're just doing it differently because it was Al Horford, right, before would pick up the other big. Now they're just defending those bigs and saying, these bigs, they're not going to be somebody who's going to post us up or mash us down inside. And then it also, the number one screen guy for most teams still tends to be their center. So when a team brings the center into the action, and Boston likes to switch a lot, they're switching Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown or Drew Holiday onto the ball handler, which is a matchup they'll happily live with versus switching Porzingis onto somebody. That was something they did a lot against the Suns on Saturday night, where they defended Jusuf Nurkić with a smaller guy, just saying they're not going to throw straight post up to Nurkić, so let's just kind of deal with whatever we deal with there. Let Porzingis float. He floated off Royce O'Neal, David Roddy, whoever else was out there. He just wasn't defending them, and they just kind of lived with whatever the resulting matchups were when they switched off of Durant or Beal as ball handlers, and it worked out pretty good.
It's a strategy that I truly love, and the one that catalyzed it for me was a preseason game where the Spurs had Victor Wembanyama guarding Andrew Wiggins, and basically his entire role was to mess up everything else. You know, like to basically it was, you know, like be around Wiggins, and he had a couple of wild, not chase down blocks, but like late contest, and he got one of Wiggins' threes, which was unbelievable. And there's a little bit of a clarification that I like to put on this, which is it's not necessarily about the team's worst offensive player. It's about the player who's the least likely to be used in their primary actions. Because if you're thinking about what you want, and that's what you brought up with Porzingis and the switching and everything else like that, is you, let's say, you know, you brought up Royce O'Neal or David Roddy. There are ways that you can have, like, certain teams are more adept than others at using, limited shooters as screeners and everything else. But there are some players, various different stripes, who just don't do that. You know, and that's why Andrew Wiggins was such a fascinating one in that Wembanyama game I invoked, is that that's not really the way the Warriors run their offense. They don't really have him do that much. And in the regular season, and to even to a lesser extent in the postseason, it's too much to ask to totally change what you're doing just for one opponent, and not even one opponent, for one situation of one opponent.
Yeah, absolutely. You need to be in a position where, I think we saw this come up with the Bucks, you know, for years and years, and it was always kind of the maybe single biggest criticism of Mike Budenholzer was, do they have adjustments? Can they go to anything different? If a team can solve the drop coverage on defense, what are you going to do? And I do think that got a little overblown, because sometimes I think their problems were more execution versus scheme. But I think in Boston's case, what we've seen, it really started under Brad Stevens, continued under Ime Udoka, and now it's continued under Joe Mazzulla. They're not married to any one thing. If switching is what they think is best, they're going to switch everything. If switching everything with a big, in this case, Porzingis, they also do it with Luke Kornet, just kind of floating around the back line, they're going to do that too. If they think playing zone, which they've done quite a bit, and they kind of, when they zone this year, one of the things they've said is Drew Holiday's kind of the captain of the zone, which is, their zone is really fun to watch, because they'll zone for about the first 15 to 17 seconds of a possession, and then they have some kind of call sign where Holiday calls it out, and then everybody just guards whoever the closest man is for the end of the possession, which then you can see teams like, wait, we've been working against this, now all of a sudden it's man, like, what is happening? Then the very best teams have caught them a couple times, because they'll send a cutter through, and now you've got two guys occupying one space, and then just the defense gets a little messy with that. But they're really malleable on that end of the floor. And then I think offensively, a lot of the same clutch criticisms are there. Tatum holds it too long. There's a lot of just dribble into, you know, nothing good comes of it, and that does happen. But against the Suns, they're up. They were up five late, and they went to Tatum. This was with probably about a minute and a half, 2 minutes to go, and Tatum got it. Drew Holiday came up. He said one of those kind of like ghost slip screens. Tatum immediately got it to him in the middle of the paint. Holiday kicked it to Horford for a three. Next possession down, they ran a similar look. Holiday never even got all the way there, because Tatum saw them cheating, and Tatum just put it on the floor and went right to the rim for a layup. And that, to me, is like, this is progress. In the immediate moment, progress. You got criticized for holding it too long against Denver down the stretch, and here it was the very next game that they played, he immediately, you know, played differently and played better in that spot. Now, is that going to last? That's the question we all, you know, we won't know until we know, you know, but that's where I think, you know, it's one of those things, as you look at it, it's like, all right, all I can go off of is what I'm seeing right now in the moment. And in the moment, it looks like they are trying. So that part of it, I'm happy with, because that's like the last next step for them is just consistently close out games, because everything else is there. People criticize how many three-pointers they take. I don't have any issue with it, because I think they do a better job of their shot mix than people ever give them credit for doing most games. Are they going to shoot themselves out of it? Sure, but every team does every once in a while. But they've also shot themselves into a whole heck of a lot of games, into a whole bunch of blowouts too, where it's just an avalanche and nobody can do anything with them. So I really do feel like they're in a place where it just feels different this time around. Even if, yes, of course, I, you know, as a Celtics guy, I would have liked to seen them perform a little bit better against the Nuggets, especially the Cavs game. Just, that's just one of those weird regular season games. Stuff happens. And, you know, Dean Wade, I don't know if he's made a three-pointer in his last couple games after going crazy. Like, he just, you know, that's just how it goes sometimes. But yeah, it does feel different to me with the Celtics this time around.
I've been thinking back a fair amount to the line that Jason Tatum had, which I fully agree with, where basically he's like, we lose so rarely that all of our losses feel like a big deal. And it is true. Like, I've watched a much higher proportion, either full games or partial games, of the Celtics losses than I have their wins, in part because they have, like many teams, a lot of their losses are the matchups that are most relevant for my purposes of potential postseason and all that kind of stuff. Like, for example, I watched every second of both Denver games. But, you know, Boston's overall offensive crunch time execution has been very good. They're the sixth best clutch net rating team in the league, plus 19, basically, which is fantastic. They're 19-10 in games that fit this criteria, which is within the last 5 minutes. And there are some notable failings against some better teams, and that's going to happen. But I agree with you that it's encouraging that Tatum responded to a game that was below his standards with doing some of the things that he didn't against Denver. And the last point I want to make on that, that was just striking to me in that game, is, and Aaron Gordon is the forefront of this, was Boston is an exceedingly, they're the most talented team in the league, and they're an athletic team as well, though I think their athleticism advantage has waned with some of the personnel moves they made. Not that I'm criticizing them at all, it's just they made other choices, sure. They got better. I noticed a meaningful difference in the applied athleticism of the Nuggets versus the Celtics, and that matters in a couple ways. So yeah, Aaron Gordon throwing down some highlight dunks is a part of it, but like Peyton Watson had a couple of big plays, and then KCP, it's not the jump up in the air and dunk all over you, but it's like his quickness and everything else. And so it will be notable to watch when Boston plays teams that have those strengths. The really, really good thing for Boston is almost no one does. Like, there just aren't that many teams that are simultaneously able to out-athlete Boston and good enough that it actually matters. Because there are, you know, most of the elite athleticism teams in the league, as things stand right now, and this is often true, just don't have the horses. Like, they don't have the shooting, or they'll have some other fatal flaw. So I don't think that it is necessarily a hyper-relevant thing in most matchups. Like, there are only a couple of teams where I think that could be, like, a real big issue. But there were points where it's like, oh, if Drew Holiday or if Jaylen, you know, who had a very good game against Denver, if it gets late and they have, it's basically like do something time, they don't necessarily have the same kind of advantage that they do against the average NBA team or even an above average team.
I agree with that. I think, too, even if we flip it to like the other end of the floor against, say, Denver, you also have to be very smart about picking your spots with playing certain guys.
Yes.
The one that stood out there is Peyton Pritchard, because he ended up playing a lot of the Jokic minutes. And it's a regular season game. Peyton Pritchard has been a key portion of the Celtics regular season rotation. But I think we get to a finals matchup, either Peyton Pritchard, we all know everybody shrinks their rotations, either he gets shrunk out, or it's going to be, all right, the 6 minutes or so that Jokic sits each half, usually start the third and fourth quarters, you're not out there. Like, that's the only time you're out there, because it wasn't Jokic like, all right, get me on Pritchard and let me back him down and score. It was Jokic just, let me get to my spot. Okay, who is Pritchard covering? Make sure that we've gotten something advantageous there, and I'm just going to throw it to that guy.
Yes.
Then that guy's going to end up making a play. And that's where you have to be so careful with the Nuggets, because Jokic is such an in-the-moment problem solver. I say now in the league, like that lob he threw to Aaron Gordon, the last, might have been Denver's last bucket, but it was at least their last big basket that they had that kind of clinched the game. It's Jokic and LeBron, and nobody else has thrown that pass, because no one else is even going to think to throw that pass. Like, did everybody else there is going to take the turnaround or the fall away, and you're going to live with it because it would have been a fine shot. But Jokic is just such a, there's just very little you can do to him that's going to take him more than maybe a play or two live on the court to solve and figure out. And that is one of the things where you have to, in order to do that, I don't know that you can scheme it, but what I think you can do is try to out-personnel it as best you can,
mm-hmm.
where it is, don't give him spots to find to attack. Just remove some of those guys from the equation. And that's where I think we could see some of those things come into play. I think Joe Mazzulla is using the regular season as somewhat of a testing ground on, all right, what does it look like if we defend Jokic with Porzingis, which they did a lot in this second game. And it didn't go great because he's Nikola Jokic. So then it was, all right, what if I throw Xavier Tillman on him a little bit? What if we give Horford some reps? All right, what if we just go small and try to give him a different look? I think he's trying to game plan it with a sense of, yeah, we want to win this regular season game, but we know there's a good chance we're going to see these guys again in June if we get to where we want to be. So let's maybe have have some stuff ready that we can go back and look on film and say, hey, this worked. And I think to your other point, too, I know you said this a while ago, I think it is now being forgotten a little bit, other than the fact that it was Jason Tatum and he missed a big shot. Boston had the ball in the air with under a minute to go to take the lead.
Yeah.
And a wide open Jason Tatum corner three, I don't care if he's missed 100 of those. I'm going to take that shot every day. Like, it's just a shot that I'm going to trust it will probably go in more often than not. So I do want to, I felt like so many people were ready to just bail and be like, well, that's it. The same old Celtics. They can't ever beat a good team. And it's like, yeah. And I get it. Denver also shot extremely poorly from three. So that there's things the Nuggets, I'm sure, walked away with saying, hey, we can do better too. Mostly I was left with feeling pretty good. And also very biasedly and selfishly, I want seven games of it come June.
And especially when I watched that game, I'm like, this is an extremely high level game between two high level teams. And that's really, I appreciate NBA contests at every level of quality. I sometimes enjoy the bad ones. Sometimes I truly hate them, but I watched that game and felt invigorated, and that's what you want to do. And so it'll be, hopefully it happens. There are a lot of twists and turns that could occur on this road. We don't know, but I would be very happy to see it again.
Yeah, as I repeated to someone, I believe it was on a radio hit after, as I said, I think if you're not a fan of any one of the other teams that's in playoff contention, or you're just a general basketball fan, you want that, but there are going to be, I don't know, 8-10 other teams that are going to have a lot of say in, hey, no, we're not cool with rolling over. I keep saying what's been so fun right now is in the NBA, and it's felt this way for the past probably about 4-ish years at least, there is no Warriors-Cavs hanging over the entire league, where it felt like for a period there, and it reasonably so, because they met every year in the finals, it felt like unless something goes seriously wrong for one of them, there's almost nothing we can do. And I know teams came close to knocking them off. The Thunder came close. The Rockets came close with the Warriors. Boston came close to knocking out Cleveland one year. But you always kind of felt like, yeah, we went in October knowing it was going to be Warriors-Cavs, and here we are in June, and it's Warriors-Cavs. I think it'll be Celtics-Nuggets, but you could give me probably 7 or 8 other matchups, and I'd be like, all right, I see how you got there. And that, to me, is what makes it a lot of fun going down the stretch. I think that makes seeding and matchups really important. Not seeding as far as home court quite as much, but just seeding for matchups, I think, becomes really important. Now, that's going to be a lot of fun to monitor over the next, we only get about a month left now in the regular season. That's always fun to come down the stretch that way.
For sure. And, yeah, I used to sometimes describe it as the holding pattern, where we kind of knew where the story was going to go, and it made with meaning it was going to end in a Cavs Warriors final, meaning that it felt even in the moment like the other stuff mattered less. Yeah. Where it was like, okay, there are ways that it could surprise, and the year that Curry got hurt and the year that KD got hurt and all those other things, but it is fun to have it change over and to have it be, yeah, nothing feels inevitable. And unfortunately, injuries are a part of that too. But it really does feel that way for me. And lots more to discuss, but first, a message from Prize Picks. Prize Picks is the largest daily fantasy sports platform in North America, the easiest and most exciting way to play DFS. It's just you against the numbers. Instead of battling thousands of other players, including pros and sharks, you pick more than or less than on 2-6 player stat projections and watch the winnings roll in. And even better, you can now win up to 100 times your money on Prize Picks with as little as 4 correct picks. You can turn $10 into $1,000 with NBA, NHL, and college basketball entries today on Prize Picks, America's number one fantasy sports app. And football season may be over, but the action on the floor is heating up. Whether it's tournament season or the fight for playoff home court, there's no shortage of high-stakes basketball moments this time of year, so get in on the action with Prize Picks, where you can turn your hoops knowledge into serious cash. This is such a great time. I mean, getting into fun college basketball and, of course, pro basketball. And one of the things that I really enjoy about Prize Picks is that it's player specific. So if you think that a player, LeBron James, or a lesser light, I mean, you can nail those too, hopefully, that has a really favorable matchup or a really unfavorable matchup, all you have to do is pick more than or less than. It's also a great time to try out Prize Picks, because if you download their app today and use the code CLNS, you get a first deposit match up to $100. Again, download the app today and use the code CLNS for a first deposit match up to $100. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy at PrizePicks. It just so happens that the next thing I wanted to talk with you about, the Celtics are part of the forefront with that too, and that's the second apron. And you and I are both salary cap dorks, and not Celtics, but Mattish Bia, the owner of the Suns, actually talked about this more openly than I think any owner has so far.
Yes.
about the second apron and how it, like, he was phrasing it and how it's not going to affect their decision making, but also, like, you could tell from his answer and how it is, like, the idea of, like, yeah, these consequences with the frozen pick and how, like, they're not going to worry about it, but it certainly seems like they are aware. And why the Celtics are at the forefront of that is because they are unambiguously a great team. Like, they are the most talented team in the league to me, but there will be a point where the question is not, do we want to stay good? It's, are we willing to sacrifice what it takes long-term, short-term to be this good as long as it's expensive?
Yeah, I think there is, I think that's a good way to put it. I also put it in a simpler sense of, are we good enough to be this expensive?
Sure. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. I tend to think it is for Boston, which is, don't get me wrong, they're doing just fine. I don't think anybody in the Celtics is struggling to pay any bills here, but they are not, this is not Steve Ballmer and the Clippers. they don't have the revenue base that the Warriors have. They don't even own their own building. So they're not bringing in that revenue like some of the other franchises are, because they're just in a different place. So I think for them, this is a historic commitment that they've made this year and moving forward as it stands right now. And I think the question is going to be, as long as you are, I'll say, in the finals mix, meaning you're competitive in the East Finals, I think you can continue to stretch this window to a point where it is, all right, we're going to stay very expensive. We're going to stay a second apron team. I think they've positioned themselves well enough to work around some of the second apron restrictions. They, for example, they have not traded a ton of draft picks in the future. They've got a couple outstanding picks, but they don't have multiple picks out the door like Phoenix does, where it's going to be, man, your team kind of is what it is because you're this expensive and you don't have draft picks. So that becomes really a major challenge. But I think for the Celtics, the question is going to be, if they step back at all, if they have a season or two in a row where it is, man, we fell short, we didn't even get to the conference finals, or we were there, but it wasn't really competitive, that's where it starts to become a whole other set of questions. I look at, for them, this is really a two-year window. It's this year and next year, and then the major decision points come when you'll have Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown making a combined $100 million plus Kristaps Porzingis in the final year at $30.7 million. Then that is, Derek White will likely be on a new contract by then. We'll see what happens with Jrue Holiday. I tend to think very likely he opts out and then signs an extension right now where it is, I don't know, $120 million over 4 years or something like that, where it lowers his number. Then that puts him, you know, more in play to stick around. He's been very clear.
Like his former teammate, Chris Middleton.
Exactly. And he's been very clear of, hey, Boston already is home for us. Like, and I don't think him and his family want to move again at this point. And if they do, I think it's going to very much be, all right, wherever we go next, that's it. Like, to the level of anything can be, that's it in the NBA. Obviously, you can always be traded. But I really think they've really put themselves in this position where it's this year and next, and then we'll figure all the rest of it out. And obviously, everybody goes to, all right, does that mean Jaylen Brown has to be traded if you get there? Well, I don't know that it's he has to be. I think that becomes the, well, this is our get out of jail free card in the sense of clean up the books. And in addition to cleaning up the books, we also will get, ideally, a pretty good return for Jaylen Brown in whatever trade we get. And we're kind of resetting at that point around a kind of core group, I'm guessing, of Tatum, White, Porzingis, probably maybe Jrue Holiday. We'll see what it looks like. But yeah, they are extremely, you know, committed to this group, which is not a place we've always seen. That this is a team that for several years running made moves where they gave up players who maybe could have been helpful at a point in the playoffs just because it was, let's make sure we get it out of the tax. So let's, you know, we can, so let's do it. And I never have a huge criticism of if you can get out of the tax. My criticism came of, you know, you get out of the tax by getting rid of a guy who might have been able to help.
Right.
And that's where it always felt a little off to me.
I think that you phrased it very well. And for the Celtics, another important part of, let's say it's kind of a 2-year evaluation window right now, is also what is going to happen around the league and finances during that time. So presumably during this window, we're going to get at least the basic contours of the next national TV deal. We will also potentially start to get a resolution on the RSN question, which is, mm-hmm. I think, a little bit overstated in terms of how much it affects revenue relative to the national TV deal, but it does matter. And that gives you a lot of insight into where the cap is going, where the tax is going, where the second apron is going. And I on Real GM's salary cap sheet, they have the projected second apron tied to the, because you could do that, tied to the tax rates. I actually asked them to do that because it was hard for me to do. And so I'm like, yeah. hey, you could do this there. And so obviously the Celtics have a great front office. They're doing this themselves and they have access. And it is important to note that it will be different this time around than it was for, I mean, the most extreme is probably 2016, where like the spike and the KD Warriors and everything else, like the Celtics will not be saved even by a massive national TV deal because of the restrictions that the owners and players put in where the cap can't go up more than 10%. But yeah. 10% over a couple of years can still make the math a lot easier for them. We'll see where that goes. So
If I can say one thing real quick on that 10%, if it hits that 10%, the most important thing that I think sometimes gets missed, if the league gets to a point where whether it is 10% organically or it is 10% because it should have been 15 and we have the spillover catch-up effect going on for, you know, the smoothing purposes that they put in, 10% still outpaces the 8% raises.
It does.
In any individual player salary. And that's the part. I know it sounds like it's 2%. Who cares? But we're talking 2% off of $100 million deals. It does start to add up very, very quickly in that sense. So that is for a team like Boston that's going to have at least two guys on those max deals, that does end up mattering. Now, if it's the cap only goes up 3.5, like it's kind of projected to right now, or 4 or 5, well, then the player raises outpace the cap, and that becomes a problem almost the other way. So that's those are the things that I think sometimes people start thinking, it's like, you're talking about like 2 and 3%. Who really cares? Yeah, but we're talking 2 and 3% of closing in on $200 million for the cap itself. Like that's huge. You know, that does end up really mattering.
On that front, there's one other big one that I've been fixated on, and you brought up the idea that it could be a smaller increase this year, which I expect as well. I don't know. The NBA is notoriously conservative in the early going, but there are some complicated factors this year, which is there is an expectation, and I think it's a fair one, that 25-26, first year of the new national TV deal, it will go up 10%. However, what you're building that 10% on, just like the starting salary of a contract, matters a ton. So if this year is a 4% raise, and then even if it's, you know, 10% moving forward, that 4% versus, let's say, 8%, that actually has gigantic ripples through the rest of this TV deal, because you're that original calculation, you start at a higher point, so 10% of a higher number is a higher number, and yep. then that cascades over the rest of it, depending on where the actual numbers are and everything else. So there is an argument for the Celtics that even if the year that matters the most for their evaluation is 25-26, that 24-25 is actually the bigger number, because that's what sets the table. And that's going to be, you know, like where we go from here. And that's going to be key to watch. And that's also true for the Clippers. To an extent, that's also true for the Suns. And you brought up a really important point about evaluation and kind of like, well, where are we? What are we doing? And I like to use the Warriors as a contextual example of that, where I genuinely believe that Joe Lacob would be willing to spend a significant sum of money. And he is not as individually wealthy as Ballmer and some of these other people as well, mm-hmm. though they do have the revenue base as you've talked about. However, how they evaluate this season and what things are moving forward matters a lot. And they got a lot more to chew on, I would say, so far this season than the Celtics have. Where the Celtics, it's like full steam ahead, we're damn good, the playoffs will be their own thing, and maybe they feel better or worse. I mean, if they win the title, then it's like, well, let's just keep this ride going as long as we can, and hopefully Tatum agrees to re-up and all that. But the Warriors this year, you know, right now they're hovering just over 500, but if Steph Curry, you know, misses a couple more games, if things go a little bit poorly, they could easily be below again, as they have been for times this year. And it is significantly less palatable to be relatively uninspiring and have this kind of a commitment. And so, like, will the Warriors make that sort of a commitment? You know, because, like, Klay Thompson's up for his contract, and then you have, you know, like, the possibilities of trades and the Chris Paul salary slot and everything else. And I think that story becomes really relevant for the Suns, because they have really good players, but they have a kind of a weird roster. They have a flawed roster. And right now, you know, in part because of the availability issues that they've had, they're doing well, but they're not ridiculous. And, like, for example, I don't expect the Suns to win the title this year. I don't expect them to make a lot of noise, though they have the talent to prove me wrong, and it would be fun to see. And so I use the phrase defining success a lot, because I think that it's useful for understanding where a front office is, where their heads could be at. And with the Warriors, I think that the idea is basically, well, what would this money do for us? And I don't know that Steve Ballmer cares about that, because his world is completely different than everybody else's. But for the Celtics, but more for the Suns, like, I don't think that point of reckoning is now. I don't think that point of reckoning is next year. But even if Matishbia, and this is part of why his quotes were so enlightening, even if Matishbia feels like, well, full steam ahead right now, you're constantly in a state of evaluation and reevaluation. And part of why I dislike the second apron viscerally, because I love good teams being together, great teams more specifically, is it's always going to weigh on you. It's significant enough with the increases now that the luxury tax calculations are going to shift soon, and the frozen picks and everything else, where you have to have a more frequent, more open conversation with, I like to use management here rather so, because it's owners are the most important deciders here, owners and the front office, of saying, well, what is this sacrifice on the court? What is the sacrifice to my pocketbook, and how long, and how do we clean it up? And I wish those conversations didn't have to happen as aggressively as I know they're happening now.
Yeah, without a doubt. And that's what becomes very interesting to me. And in word, I don't think the second apron, even with the, like, let's say, half measures that they've already instituted, which are kind of the right now, here's the things that impact you. We clearly saw Boston, the Milwaukee, Phoenix basically say, okay, cool, this is our last year to load up. Let's do that. We can make, they all made acquisitions that they could not have made otherwise in future years, just with the way the salary matching rules are going to change in trades, if nothing else. So they went and loaded up their teams, and off they went. Where I think the idea was really, hey, wait, you were supposed to take this year to start getting things in line before we really handed down the punishments. And this is the, you know, the unintended consequences, right? Of, oh man, we thought everybody would use it as the, I said it was supposed to be the gap year, or the, as I like to call it, the get your books in order year. But they said, no, let's load up, let's go. But now what I'm looking at is, when I start looking forward with teams starting this coming off season and then moving forward down the line, is I think there are two different things you have to ask yourself when you're there as part, and this has to be where ownership and the front office have to be in lockstep. And the first question is, can we afford it? Just period. Can we afford it? Can we afford to be this expensive? And I think for teams like Minnesota, Milwaukee, Memphis, that's a real question mark. Mm-hmm. Can we afford to be this expensive? Then I think the next thing is, are we good enough, and can we build a roster? Because of the expense thing, this is where I look at the Clippers. The Clippers could pay 10 times what they pay now, and Steve Ballmer would only just probably start to feel it. I think for the Clippers, though, the question that will ultimately come in for Lawrence Frank and the front office group is, hey, it's too hard for us to build a functional roster, which that's where I think the Warriors are. Mm-hmm. I think if the Warriors were still in a place of, hey, we just got to keep paying whatever it takes, and every year we'll go sign Dante DiVincenzo for the taxpayer MLE, and yes, his $5 million salary will end up costing us $30 million in real money, but whatever, that's the best thing for the team. I think now what's happened is teams like the Warriors, I think the Nuggets are going to be there, I think maybe potentially sooner than a lot of people realize. The question's going to have to start to be, wait, can we actually build a functional roster around the really expensive temples we have versus where are we going as far as just it's too much? So now you add that, those two kind of parameters or factors or however you want to think of it, to what we said in just the, are we good enough to spend this much? Because you certainly can't. Like, the Grizzlies are coming up on being a second apron team, or at least dancing around the second apron. And we all know this year is just the wheels came off. It's this, you know, they're going to throw this year away and move forward. But let's say next year they don't bounce back to being the we're challengers in the West Grizzlies we all thought. They are not going to stay a team that is dancing around the second apron. I feel very confident in that. If Minnesota flames out earlier than expected in this postseason or falls short a year from now, they're not going to carry the team that is up around the second apron because I just don't know that they can afford to be there. And then I think you have teams like Boston, the Lakers, even I think that's where the Warriors are, is, hey, we're no longer good enough to justify this, and we have no other way out of it than get out of this, open up some of the team building tools we need, and move forward. And that's what's really making it interesting, because it used to be for a little while there, you had a handful of teams that they could just outspend everybody to a reason. And now you've got these things that are, it's not that you can't still outspend everybody, you can still afford to do it. But the challenge is, can you actually build a real roster? And that's what we're going to run into. And I find it funny, to circle it back to the Suns and to Matt Ishbia. One, I find it funny that, you know, some of the comments he made, you pair that with, well, we're only about a year or so away from them kind of saying, yeah, we don't really care about the draft. Like, we scout 10 players or whatever it is. And that's, which I think there was a lot of hyperbole and nonsense in those comments too, because I find that very hard to believe that's how they treat the entire process of incoming players. I just, that seems strange to me. But if the idea is going to be, hey, we don't care about draft picks because we would rather have veteran minimum player X than any drafted player we could get at the end of the first round, which is where we're hoping to be picking every year, we don't care about frozen picks and picks we can't trade and all these other things, because we're in a spot where it is just here. And then I do wonder too, if some of these teams, if I can really flip it way down the line, if one of the unintended consequences is going to be, hey, Team X got a pick frozen now, whether it's Boston or Phoenix or Milwaukee or Denver. That pick got frozen. They would have traded it otherwise, which then by the time players X, Y, and Z have aged out or moved on, they would be without that pick, which is where Phoenix probably will be in a few years. Now they're still going to have that pick.
And by that point, it's a better pick.
Exactly.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought about it that way. I love that.
Instead of not having the pick, now you've given them almost, here's your reset. Now you're going to stumble and fall into a top five pick, and you're going to be able to get a great player, ideally, right, if it's a good enough draft and you draft well enough, and off you go again. You're kind of moving right back up. And then if you're a ownership, Steve Ballmer, Matt Ishbia, the Lakers, that is willing to pour money into the team, all right, we've aged out, we moved on, we stumbled back, now we're rebuilding around, you know, the next Victor Wembanyama-ish player. That's probably way too high of praise, but somebody who's really, really good, and we're moving on with that, because in any other world, we would have traded that pick. So we would have traded that first round pick for we needed a bench shooter, so we went and traded the pick to go get a bench shooter. Now you can't, so you've almost kind of given them that, hey, we're going to protect you in the back end of this, where we know the idea was really, no, you can't trade the pick because it's going to be, you know, where it is. So that's something I think is going to turn point to a long-term unintended consequence that I don't know a lot of attention has been paid to, because the reality is we're talking 7, 8, 9, 10 years down the line. And a lot of people are like, what do I, I'm not going to be the one making those decisions anyway. So I, you know, it doesn't really matter for me to think about it. But I think when we're sitting there looking at Real GM's protected or draft pick page, we're gonna be like, oh man, they're going to have a pretty good pick that year, because that's one they weren't allowed to trade.
Lots more to discuss, but first a message from Mood. Mood is an interesting product for me. As a new father, I have to pick my spots, be pretty judicious with certain products, but I really enjoyed how Mood described the different things that they were going for, creative, focused, energized, even though I, for logical reasons, focused more on the sleep-based elements of it. And Mood is known for their federally legal THC. Now they're adding their most potent product yet to the lineup, introducing hemp-based THCA flower, the future of legal THC, tried along with Mood's other amazing offerings like flowers, gummies, vapes, and more. And for a limited time, Mood is giving Real GM Radio listeners a free THCA pre-roll and 20% off your first order. Just visit hellomood.com and use the code REALGM. And as I mentioned, for me, sleep is more of a focus that can be a challenge. And so I really appreciate anything that can make that easier. I was, of course, impressed by what they can do there. And I haven't tried it yet, I'll be honest, but I am really excited about this announcement about the THCA flower. It's fascinating because THCA converts to THC when you heat it, so you get access to that classic marijuana high. And Mood has 10 different high-inducing strains, the most potent they've ever offered. So you can try Mood's new THCA flower today. For a limited time only, get 20% off your first order plus a free THCA pre-roll. Just go to hellomood.com, HELLOMOOD.com, and use the promo code REALGM. Again, hellomood.com, REALGM, for a 20% discount on your first order and a free THCA pre-roll. It's a fascinating point. I'm really happy you made it. It may turn into a piece for one or both of us at some point. But I want to get into, you made a lot of interesting comments during that. And one of the ones that I was thinking about, you talked about how hard it is to build a roster in the kind of the new era as a second apron team. And I think this year has been a reminder, this is not new information, but a reminder of how hard it is to use... How hard it is to use these limited team building tools to add credible depth. And so for me, like, I use the Bucks and the Suns as two examples. So Milwaukee, one of the elements that they've done is they've been pretty aggressive to save some money, and understandably so. They're spending a lot. I'm not criticizing them in any way, shape, or form. Their overall spending level is high. Yes. With using late second round picks to, because they're calculated differently for the cap and the tax and everything else, having late second round picks and filling out, let's say, the 13th, 14th, 15th, or 12th, 13th, 14th, depending on what you're carrying, with these second round picks. And for them, your hope is that you can get maybe every year, every couple of years, you can get a rotation player out of it. And they've had, you know, Andre Jackson's interesting. They've had a couple of guys that have, you know, kind of can get there. So that's one. And then the second one is you brought up Phoenix and the minimum salaries. And a lot of those guys, they gave player options to make it a little juicier, which actually cost Mashbeal a lot of money, because a one year and a 2 year contracts are not subsidized the same way by the league. And what I think this year, when you think about the aggressive trades that the Suns made at the deadline, what this was a reminder of is that the hit rate on both of those is very low. Like, the even if I thought the Suns did a great job on minimum contracts in the offseason. I thought they, you know, like with Eric Gordon. I was talking about him earlier. Eric Gordon, and I loved Yuta Watanabe and various, you know, Kata Bates Diop and all that. And most of those guys did not live up to expectations. And the shorthand for that is, like, even if they weren't necessarily a pure minimum guy, minimum players are usually available for the minimum for a reason. Yep. And that is not to say they are bad and will always be bad, but the upside of that, the best case scenarios are usually lower, because if they were way higher, then it's a lot harder to turn down to turn down $10 million for a minimum than it is $5 million, like, for example. And so they're, like, the idea basically being that for the Warriors, and you brought this up with DiVincenzo, or for the examples of the Suns and the Bucks, what they have left, especially now that we're going to be out of this get your books in order year, is going to be tough. So if your team is not good enough at that moment in time, getting them better is going to be incredibly hard unless you have young talent on your team and the kind of the right salary structure to make a trade legal, which is going to be really hard to sweeten the pot and bring in that player. But for most of these teams, that's not going to be possible.
Yeah, it's going to be really hard. That's why I always bring up with Boston, they could hit a point where it is the right thing to do is trade Jaylen Brown with almost very little to do with what he means to the team. It really turns into we can get the best return back. Because the other thing is, like, the Suns, they've got a couple other guys, right? They've got Nasir Little on the books, but that's such a small salary amount. Under the new rules, you can't combine. You can no longer say, all right, we're going to put Nasir Little and Yusuf Nurkic together in a package and go get player X. You can't do that anymore. You can only take back, only trade one player away. You can only take back as much as you send out, exactly even. There's no more buffer on it that gives you ability to take back more money. So that becomes a major challenge. And I think with Boston, you may be looking at it and saying, geez, you know, Jaylen Brown makes $50 million. We can trade Jaylen Brown for 2-3 rotation guys. And Team X needs a Jaylen Brown more than they need 2 or 3 rotation guys. And off we go. And that's how we've kind of reset around it. I also think something that we may end up seeing, and I think this is going to come to a head very soon for Phoenix. And I don't even know if it gets to the offseason. I think we may see it during the last couple months here of extensions before we flip to the offseason. Is what do they do with Grayson Allen or Royce O'Neal? Because I think those two guys, they've talked about these are important guys. We want to have these guys here long term with us. And I think what you may see is, let's say they say Royce O'Neal is an $8 million player. Well, you know what? Whether it's in a new contract or whatever, let's give Royce O'Neal 15 because we can live with the additional hit. We can pay that if that's what Matt Ishbia is saying. We're not going to let the additional tax penalties be burdensome to us. And now Royce O'Neal becomes $15 million in tradable salary. And that becomes a number where, as long as you don't get crazy, if you came out and said, hey, we're paying Royce O'Neal $30 million, well, now no one's going to trade for him because that's a ridiculously bad contract. At 15, if you could juice it the right way, you're probably fine. You could do that. And I think we're going to see a couple contracts this summer, especially from a couple of these second apron teams that look a little weird, where it's like, wow, that was a little bit more than I thought that guy was going to get. Because the idea is, whether it's by the trade deadline or it's in year 2 or 3 of a deal, it is, all right, that guy's actually tradable. We can do that. The key has to be, you have to be able to sustain the penalty if you can't trade the player. You need to be able to say, well, we couldn't trade him, so we can just still eat the extra money that this is costing us. And that's going to be, again, front office and ownership being in lockstep and saying, all right, hey, we can kind of do this. Like you mentioned, it's a smaller scale, but the Suns saying, hey, in order to get players X, Y, and Z, we had to give them player options. And Matt Ishbia is saying, all right, that's fine. I'll take the additional $1 million hit right now in salary plus, I don't know, probably about $4 or $5 million in real dollars when we add in the penalties. So I think you're seeing that's just a bigger scale of that, of, you know, let's eat a little bit more money if we can't. But what this does is gives us different options down the line. In addition to, if the very simple and easy situation of, if Royce O'Neal and Grayson Allen walk, that doesn't save the Suns enough where all of a sudden it's like, well, now we've got even the taxpayer, Emily. It's going to be, those guys are gone. And guess what? We're still super duper expensive. We can't really replace them. So
yeah, and we don't have any legal tools to, like,
exactly.
It doesn't give you any additional options. So that's,
I like to think of it. I know you talk a lot about the bird rights trap. It's like the bird rights trap, but like a steroid version of it.
Yes.
Where it's like, it's kind of the bird rights trap because you got their bird rights with no way to replace them, but you really have. Otherwise, you were literally replacing this guy with another veteran minimum signing. And now you're talking about a roster that went from being pretty top heavy to extremely top heavy. The last thing I'll say related to that is I think whether it comes this summer or down the line, I think what we are far more likely to see, which I kind of hinted at with Jaylen Brown, but I think for some of these teams that are really expensive, is it is less likely we will see it turn into we traded $50 million player for $50 million player. I think it's going to be what the Lakers did with Russell Westbrook, which is we traded a $40 million player for three guys who make $40 million and fleshed out our rotation and built a roster that's a lot more functional, because that's what's going to end up, in my opinion, that's what will end up killing these teams. It'll be less about the superstar talent at the top. It'll be, do we have the depth to get all the way through the 82-game regular season and then another, let's call it 16 to 20, well, 16 on the minimum end, but 20, 25 playoff games to get to where we want to be? Like, do we have enough to play a 100-game season and get all the way where we want to be? And I think sometimes you're going to see some of these teams say, yeah, we didn't. That's where we ultimately fell short, is by the time we didn't have enough for the regular season. So by the time we got to the playoffs, we were on fumes. Our guys were gassed. That's what happened to the Lakers. You could just see it. They completely ran out of gas against the Nuggets. And that's an extreme situation, because they were obviously making a run like nobody other than the Heat, who did it in the same year, did. But you see with the Heat in the finals too, they just ran out of gas too. And that's where I think Denver kind of came in with, hey, we've got depth. We've got our 8, 9, 10 guys we feel good about throwing on the court. And that's going to be the kind of interesting part of the team building there. And then who on the flip side of that is the smart team that is ready to pick off that player? Because for them, what they may have depth for days, but what they lack is that high-end guy who can lift the remaining players to a new level as all these rosters balance out.
The trade partner angle of it is a great one. And like, I think of Orlando as potentially being one of those teams a couple of years from now where they can cobble some things together depending on like what kind of contract some of their guys get next. And I think they could get their like top guy sooner rather than later. And a lot of great stuff there. I don't necessarily have, because don't have the bandwidth to get into all of it now. But the other one that I wanted to bring up, and this is, you could call this an unintended consequence of the CBA, but it has happened so much that I don't think it's fair to say that, which is, I call it pulling up the ladder. And so what the league does in all these circumstances, and the most obvious of this was the CBA after 2016, where because they want to, and this is fair, they want to implement a change, especially one as big as the second apron, more gradually, because it would be unfair to be like, we're starting this right now, and then and all the rules kick in, all the taxes and all that, because like contracts are out and everything else like that. It would be unreasonable. However, the next era of second apron teams are not going to have that grace. They are going to have very different decisions to make. And they will also presumably get to that second apron point differently, because there aren't that many, you know, we're dealing with a small sample here. And so whether that ends up being the Thunder with their really good young talent, or if the Spurs can get enough guys that are actually worth that kind of money down the line to eventually do that, or you brought the Memphis Grizzlies. And I call it pulling up the ladder because what happens is you're responding to the last way that a team got a little bit supercharged. And you're not preventing them from doing that because it's already happened. But instead what you're doing is you're saying no one else can walk that path. And I understand the desire to do that because it's you kind of have to be reactive. It would be extremely hard, though it would be super fun if they like commissioned guys like us to be like, well, instead of being reactive, let's be proactive and like kind of shut some of these doors down early rather than late. But so what that means as a practical consideration is I believe it's going to be significantly harder for that next era of second apron teams, so teams that aren't even close to it right now, to have a competent roster than it has been for the Celtics and the Clippers and to a lesser extent the Warriors and the Suns. And that is going to have some very severe consequences for competitive balance. There may be people who are happy about that. Like we've talked about how we're not sure where things are going to go. I think that the best teams, the later years of this CBA, the best teams are not going to be as good as they've been.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think we're going to see a lot more balanced league. And I think the idea of what you said, it's going to be one, it's just going to be harder to get there just because you're not going to be able to do the trade, taking on money in trades, which is historically how a lot of these teams have gotten there. Milwaukee, Boston, Phoenix. It's going to be more of, which has always been funny to me, is, you know, people screamed and yelled about the Warriors, right? It was, this is a Warriors problem. You know, they could just, you know, what was it, checkbook championships and all these other things that were said about the Warriors. But when you really look at it, the vast majority of their team was homegrown, or it was smart trades of salary slots. Like, it was, you know, they almost looked at it as a team does. Like, you hear this term in soccer and in like the NFL, a lot of a salary slot. Like, they looked at it as, well, Kevin Durant is leaving. We do not want to lose Kevin Durant's, at the time, was a 20-something million salary slot. So we are going to take D'Angelo Russell. And is D'Angelo Russell perfect? Is he a perfect fit? Absolutely not. We all knew that at the time. But their vision was, we'll trade D'Angelo Russell as a contract later down the line. So teams are not really going to be able to do that moving forward, because you're just in this spot where once you get to the apron, you are one for one, dollar for dollar in trades. But what I think is interesting is, what I wonder is if where the imbalance comes is, do we see teams do an even more extreme version of, I want to put it somewhere between like the Thunder and the process Sixers, where it's not, we're going to bottom out to the point where we're like, we're playing almost a G League roster in the NBA, which is what this continually help Oklahoma City as they move through this process. I think Oklahoma City is going to be able to reload and refill around the edges simply because of the volume of draft picks they have. Even when they do get, if they get there where they are, you know what, we blew past the apron, which I kind of hope they do, because that means the team developed and became good enough to pay all those guys and they stayed together. I think for them, then it becomes, let's refill. We have picks. We can kick a pick down the line. We don't have a spot this year nor need. All right, we'll trade this year's first round pick for a future first round pick next season, and those kind of things. And I think that's what you may see a couple teams do. And then, is there teams on the other side of that are, we're just going to keep, we will now be the new Thunder, where we're going to be bad, and there'll be elements of the Philly badness of, we're going to pick high enough in the draft, where we will pick high in the draft, we amass draft picks, and hopefully we hit on them, and then that's how we go. I think it's, the draft is going to take on an extreme new level of importance, I think, that is going to be very, very different, because even for the teams that are second apron and over, it's draft picks and minimum contracts, and that's about it, unless you are sitting on a $50 million contract you can break up into multiple players. So you have to nail those picks, and I think what we're going to see become a big thing, it became for probably decade and a half ago, it really turned into, everybody has to have a great cap guy, because like, we got to nail the salary cap stuff, because we're probably closer to 20 years on that, but it's like, this luxury tax thing is a new thing and we've got to get all this right. So like, that became like a premium front office position. I think for every team, not that every team doesn't have, you know, head scout guys for the draft and people who lead the draft process, but I think that's going to take on an increased importance, because you're going to have these teams that are, hey, even though we're picking at 25, we have to get the absolute best player at 25 that we can mold and grow. And then in tandem with that, it'll be draft people to identify and select, then player development staff.
Ooh, yeah.
That will grow them. Those are going to be the big things, where those to me seem like the kind of next edges that teams are going to be looking at. And you're going to see who puts that priority there. Like, I don't think Phoenix was being completely truthful by saying, we don't care about the draft. I think there was a lot of hyperbole and nonsense in there. But I do think for Phoenix, hey, you better start caring about it a little bit, because that's the only way you can really add guys coming forward. Now they've, you know, horcruxed up their picks and everything. thing. First person I saw say that was Zach Lowe, which, you know, was great. And I know Nate's been using that too. I'm on your show. So I think that is really, really fun way to put it. But yeah, they've done a lot of things where it's like, I don't even know what picture you're going to actually use and have, but you'll have something because you have to have some first round pick. So you better care enough to use it. You can't just sit on it. And I don't think we're going to get into a point where, because of the salary matching is so minimal, that it's going to be, hey, we made the pick, but we're turning around and trading the guy after the draft, because you're talking about trading a $2 or $3 million guy. It's not going to get you anything more than a minimum signing anyway would get you. So I think that's those are kind of, when I think big picture about where we're going roster wise, those are the things that I think start meaning a lot more. And for me personally, it's why I started to pay a lot more attention to the draft than I usually do, earlier than ever. Part of that was driven by this year. I didn't know any of these guys. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, I don't really know any of these guys, because I haven't been hearing about these guys for the last 3-4 years since they were 16 years old. They haven't been in my face like a Cooper Flagg and an Ace Bailey next year. So now I'm in a spot where it's just like, yeah, I want to kind of get into this and go. So I'm really excited to see who kind of cracks the team building code on some of this stuff, because you know there's going to be smart teams that they just figure it out sooner than other people do, and they're going to have an advantage until everybody else catches up to them.
I'm so excited to see where this goes, and I don't love the way they changed the landscape, but I am excited to see how it changes and to see where this goes from here. You and I could talk for another 5 hours about this, but I am going to thank you so much for taking the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much to Heath Smith for taking the time to come on. You can, of course, read his excellent work at SpotTrack. You can listen to his podcast, including The Front Office Show, and you can follow him, if you don't already, on social media. Love having him on. Love having this kind of a conversation. And the joy of a new CBA, even if it's one that I don't always agree with, is that we're going to have to see where some of these things work out. And the best laid plans, the best described decisions will always shift around in time. And, you know, that does shift dynamics a little bit. So we'll have to see there. And I loved having Keith on to help kind of get through that. And of course, the really interesting Celtics Nuggets game and takeaways from their week. If you want to support this show, there are a lot of ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode in the podcast player of your choosing, whether that's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever. And if we are not in a podcast player that you would like us to be, please let me know, and I will reach out to people who can actually help on that. And we've done that numerous times over the years when it is absolutely possible. You can also help other people find the show. That is through leaving a rating and review in that podcast player. That can be through social media, word of mouth. Any of that is deeply appreciated for us. But the single most important thing you can do for Real GM Radio and any other podcast that has them is to check out our sponsors, especially in this case when it is a new sponsor. And that is Mood. And so you can go to hellomood.com, HelloMood.com, use the code REALGM, REALGM, for 20% off your order plus a free THCA pre-roll. The early time for us and any other show that has a new sponsor is the most important, because that can convince them to stay on. And so you can definitely check them out, which is always exciting. You can also check out my other work, Dunked On Prime, still going strong. Nate and I did roughly a 2-hour, let's call it 1560. We didn't get through all 15 teams, especially because we spent a long time breaking down Celtics Nuggets, which was worth that kind of a breakdown. And you can also watch the NBA strategy stream that Nate and I do with League Pass. That the next one will be Rockets Spurs on Tuesday. I believe it is 5:30 Pacific, 8:30 Eastern. Should be a really fun one. And then written work at The Athletic. As I mentioned during this, Keith and my conversation may have led to a series of different columns that I'd like to write, whether I get to all of them. And Keith, of course, should have rights to many of them because they're his ideas. So you can check that out. And if you have any feedback, good, bad, or indifferent, DanielRueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is a promise. I do not always reply. I acknowledge this at the outset. I tell you this at the outset, but that is the deal. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.